This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Eri Hota, telling us today why Japan in 1941 bombed Pearl Harbor and declared what its own leaders knew to be an unwinnable war against the United States. Your book, Eri, comes with the subtitle Countdown to Infamy, and you tell the story of a tragic mistake. It is a story about human weakness and self-delusion. How did it come to pass that nearly all of Japan's politicians and military commanders could be so disastrously wrong?
I think for me, the explanation really lies in the dispersion of responsibility. Nobody, no leaders, about a dozen of them, didn't feel themselves to be responsible for the enormous decision that they were making, because the responsibility for consensus building, and even including the emperor, they were sort of sharing everything and not really owning up to anything. The decision-making process was that there was a something called liaison conference between the military government and the civilian government, and the big decisions like war entry would go up to the emperor and get imperial approval. But then the emperor himself was deemed to be above politics, so he couldn't really sway the policy at that point. So unless he was determined to veto a decision, he couldn't stop it. So there was a sense that policy was rolling and was sort of made in a vacuum in which no one person was responsible.
When does the policy, the momentum of Japanese military expansion empire in the East begin to really get underway and come into the conversation at the highest levels of Japanese government?
I think the pivotal point was 1937, when Japan entered war with China, and they hadn't planned that war. They sort of felt that if they, you know, give them a quick blow, they could just end it in their favor. But Chinese, led by Chiang Kai-shek, were not about to give up. So that was an unwinnable war that they were already fighting in 1941 for the past 4 years. So the economy was already a war economy. Censorship was rampant, and people were dressing less and less extravagantly, and it was a very oppressive, suppressed state of affairs in Tokyo.
And who is the prime minister during this, most of this period between 37 and 41? He was an aristocrat, an aesthete. You describe him as a melancholy figure in the manner of Hamlet.
Yes, he was a very melancholy man who kept to himself, who kept his thoughts to himself most of the time. So his name was Konoe Fumimaro, and he was from the second noblest next to the imperial house, a family member, which originated in the 7th century. So he had this pedigree, but he had this otherworldly air of sort of someone who couldn't be violated or defied. So he used that to a good effect to perpetuate his power, or at least remain in power for so many years. He was prime minister for nearly 3 years of the 4 years leading up to the Pacific War. So that's how his staying power worked, that nobody was going to defy him. He himself felt that he was sort of above all of them. He could afford to make mistakes, and he did make mistakes. He sort of escalated the China War from the very beginning, and he didn't want to give in to Chinese demands after the fall of Nanking, when even people in the army were saying we should just conclude this war, get out of China, or, you know, conclude in our favor. But he couldn't do that because he was very proud.
Meanwhile, there is a great deal of contention among the Japanese military, the army with different views than the navy with different views than the civilian government with different views than those emanating from the imperial palace. So there is this immense confusion of different opinions, some of them put forward with great boldness and bravado.
Yes, you're absolutely right about the sorts of divisions of the government, and different institutions had different views, different cliques had different views, even within the army or navy institutions. There were quite a great degrees of differences of opinion. Also, it's important to point out that the same person who was advocating war in an official forum could be speaking against it in private. But they felt that some of them felt, especially military men, felt that they had to put up this really hard-nosed, bold front so that their institutions or their groups won't be compromised.
Meanwhile, in those 4 years, there is the conversation going on with the United States about the power in or the sphere of influence in the Pacific. And the Japanese apparently feel that they're being humiliated by the United States and that they are losing their place in the sun.
Yes, the place in the sun really goes back to this idea of the victory over the Russians, victory over the white people in 1905, when the Japanese defeated the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War, that they were destined to lead the Asian nations was the sort of very popular idea, especially in the army, but especially, even amongst popular imagination, I think the idea that Japanese were a chosen people was there, and there were generations of people who had been socialized to believe in that myth of Japanese uniqueness. So I think the humiliation by the perceived humiliation by the Americans when they started putting moral embargoes in Japan because of its aggressive policies and wars in China, I think they took personal offense. How dare they to quibble with our own authority in their backyard?
But meanwhile, Japan in 1940 had signed the Tripartite Pact with Italy and Nazi Germany, so putting themselves really on the other side of where the United States was likely to be as an ally of Britain.
Yes, it's a very illogical decision. If you wanted to be friends with America, you wouldn't conclude such a contradictory alliance with the fascist powers. The fascist alliance, the Tripartite Pact, was actually reached by someone who knew America very well, Foreign Minister Matsuoka Yosuke, who was a foreign minister to the second Konoe cabinet. He was a believer in the sort of Metternichian balance of power. He felt that if Japan allied itself with strong powers in Europe to counter the Western alliances, they could sort of have leverage over the Americans, at least have better chances of concluding some agreement with the Americans, which really backfired. He claimed to know that Americans would only respect someone who'd speak up to them and defy them, which was really not, you know, taking into consideration the ideological differences and the ideological aversion that the Roosevelt administration felt towards Nazism.
Many of the senior Japanese leaders had spent time in the United States. I mean, that Yamamoto, who is the admiral who planned the Pearl Harbor attack, had attended Harvard. I mean, and they understood the difference in magnitude between the industrial capacity of the United States and that of Japan.
Yes, it's so ironic that Yamamoto, who knew America quite well and knew that Americans wouldn't give up only after a few initial defeats, had to plan this. But he was also a gambler, too, in real life, in his private life, and he couldn't let anybody else plan this fantastic attack because the slimmer the chance, the sweeter the victory in some ways.
But it also proved to be not only a strategic mistake, but also a tactical one, because the Japanese planes didn't bomb the storage facilities and the oil depot and left the United States in not that bad shape.
Yes, the tactical aspect of it is overlooked often because the Pearl Harbor attack is often portrayed as this tactically brilliant sneak attack that really completely took Americans by surprise. But if I remember correctly, only two of the eight battleships could not have been salvaged, and others had been either repaired or even improved to fight other battles, most notably the Battle of Midway, which really decisively sort of doomed Japan to its defeat.
A lot of your book takes account of the 6 months or 8 months between April 1941 and December 7th, 1941, and there's a lot of back and forth between America and Tokyo, and there was a chance, at least maybe a slim chance, that war could have been avoided.
I don't think anything was inevitable. They had so many opportunities to turn around if only there was somebody who stepped in and said, oh, this war that we are gradually planning is ridiculous and completely unwinnable, so let's just turn around. Let's just try to reach diplomatic peace. But then the idea that they had to plan for a maximum win while they had a chance meant that they had to prepare for war within the year, within 1941. And also the military planners also agreed that diplomacy should be given a chance, but they also didn't want to give up this idea of preparing in the meantime for an inevitable, what in their mind was increasingly becoming inevitable war.
But they also, the military planners, make sure that the diplomats don't have time. I mean, they set very arbitrary deadlines. And unless America does this or that by December 1, we're going to war and so forth. And you can't conduct diplomacy under those kinds of conditions.
Not at all. I think when the leaders gave the military planners a chance to set a deadline, I think the first one was early October deadline. I think at that point they gave up their seat in the driver's seat and let military strategies conduct Japanese diplomacy as well. And diplomatically speaking, it was a completely unrealistic deadline. Tojo, when he became prime minister later in October, tried to reverse it, admitting that it was a mistake to set such a deadline. But then he only ended up extending the deadline to early December.
Tojo was presented in American propaganda throughout the war as a dictator, a warmonger, a tyrant on the order of Hitler. But in fact, he had been against attacking the United States.
Yes, he did his share of double-talking, triple-talking when things were getting hotted up, so to speak. And he tried to play this very boastful soldier at one point. But then when he became prime minister in October, he sort of backed out and panicked and said, oh, we have to rethink this because we can't really, really win this war. He didn't quite say that. But so there is an irony that, yes, it would be easier to explain Japan's decision had there been a real dictator, because it was up to him to decide, but it was more complicated than that.
Yes, I mean, you describe an extraordinarily complicated system of government with many different institutional aspects to it, and Hirohito didn't want to go to war either, but he had no way to stop it.
I think there's room for debate whether he had a choice or not. I think constitutionally, it's a sort of a murky area. He himself believed that he could have probably vetoed the war decision at the last minute. That's why he explains himself after the war, saying that I was afraid of a coup d'etat, so rather than risk antagonizing the military, I said okay to the war plan.
Throughout 1941, beginning in January, the Japanese citizenry in Japan is living under truly miserable conditions. I mean, they almost like wartime conditions already a year before Pearl Harbor. I mean, shortages of fuel, food, so forth.
Yes, it's a testimony that they had been, in fact, fighting an unwinnable war already for 4 years in China, and that Japan was a country at war. And I think their hunger really proved their plight.
But no public outcry in the way that, you know, no war protests along the lines of, let's say, the Vietnam War protests in the United States in the 1960s. Why is that?
Well, I think it was a fascistic country or society in a way that the state controlled, or tried to control at least, every aspect of human endeavor. And every move was watched, and neighbors didn't really trust each other. And that was not really, it was a very fearful environment, and increasingly becoming fearful environment, as food had to be shared with your neighbors and so on.
It's truly a tragic story, I think, Ari, because the consequences are disastrous for Japan. I mean, what was the attitude at the end? I mean, was there any blame? I mean, was anybody thought to be responsible?
I think one of the reasons why this responsibility debate hadn't really taken off in Japan is partly because it was so complicated and it was so hard to allocate blame and clarify who started the war. But I think leaders responsible, a handful of them, really try to distance themselves by saying that, oh, we couldn't help it. We were cornered into it by external forces such as American oil embargoes. And they sort of made it a collective responsibility. There was a conscious movement by the first prime minister, another imperial prince, Higashikuni, to disengage from that debate, saying that we really have to concentrate ourselves on rebuilding society, so let's not point fingers at each other. We are all responsible, which means that nobody really is.
But I think you also show that it's clear that Japan was the aggressor bringing about the war, and you sort of, I think, put to rest the notion that the war was provoked by Roosevelt.
Yes, but unfortunately that's not really how we grow up being taught history in Japan. Or we don't really bother to ask that question anyway, because whenever I tell my Japanese friends I was writing a book on Pearl Harbor, they are genuinely sort of puzzled about the importance of such topic, because there is this lack of understanding that Japan is an aggressor, and that aggravates our relations with East Asian neighbors as well. So I think there's so many different layers to this problem, but the very fundamental lack of awareness that Japan, no matter how one tries to defend the leader's decision, was an aggressor. They fired the first shot.
Thank you, Ari Hota, for speaking with us today about Japan 1941. I'm Louis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2013.